So as we're ending, nearing the end of the eighth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, I thought I would just like to stop and reflect on some of the topics that we've discussed in this canto, because it is one of my favorites in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So many wonderful instructions and pastimes of the Lord and his devotees are described here. So I'm not sure how long ago we started. Was it over a year ago, or certainly several months ago? We were studying Gajendra's crisis and his prayers of surrender, then how Gajendra returned to the spiritual world. How the demigods and the demons declared a truce, and as part of churning the milk ocean, Lord Shiva saved the universe by drinking poison. Then there was a description of the Lord's incarnation as Mohini Murti. And again, how Mohini Murti later bewildered Lord Shiva. And then, of course, the description of Bali Maharaj and Lord Vamandev in several chapters. And finally, this discussion of the Lord's fish incarnation, Matsya. Many very wonderful instructions. And at the end of this canto, actually Srila Prabhupada, he gives a special note how he thanks his Western disciples for helping him in this great work. And at this particular time, when he finished the eighth canto, Srila Prabhupada was very encouraged. He says there that by the encouragement I'm getting from my Western disciples, I have hope that I'll be able to finish this great work before passing away. So he talks like that at the end of this eighth canto, sort of a milestone for him and for us as well. I remember when I first came to this community, I think we were reading the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And throughout all the years, we've gone canto by canto. Now we're nearing the end of the eighth canto. Well, Srimad Bhagavatam is actually understood in threes. There are three main subjects of Srimad Bhagavatam: Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. And these three topics, these three subject matters, are also understood in terms of threes: Bhagavan, Bhakta, and Bhakti. So the Sambandha, or the relationship that's spoken of in the Srimad Bhagavatam, is between Bhagavan, the Supreme Lord, and Bhakta, his devotees. And the Abhideya, subject matter of Abhideya, or the relationship, or how to understand or act in this sambandha or connection, relationship, how to act, is described by the bhakti, or the interaction between Bhagavan and the bhakta. And of course, prayojana, or the supreme goal, or the loving affairs between the Lord and his devotees, that perfection is also the perfection of the relationship between Bhagavan and Bhakta. So Srimad Bhagavatam is understood in terms of threes like this. And Parikshit Maharaj, at this point in the narration of Sukadeva Goswami, has also become very keenly aware of these three subject matters and the three ways to understand them, so that at the beginning of this last chapter of the eighth canto, when Sukadeva Goswami describes that there is a fish incarnation, immediately, as pointed out by Srila Prabhupada in a purport to one of the verses at the beginning of the chapter, immediately Parikshit Maharaj understood and asked Sukadeva Goswami, "Oh, tell me more about this fish incarnation, Matsya, and tell me about the devotee for whom the Lord incarnated as a fish." He understood this point, that Bhagavan and bhakta, they're always together. It's not that the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna, or any of the incarnations is alone. But the Lord incarnates for a particular purpose. This was being described yesterday in the class by Tamar Prabhu. He descends for a particular purpose, and that's in interacting with his devotee. So Sukadeva, Parikshit Maharaj, he can understand, and he asks, well, who was that devotee? He must have been a very special devotee for the Lord to take this very extraordinary form of a fish. And so please tell me about him. And so these verses that we're reading today, actually starting with the verse from yesterday, text number 10, introduce us to who is this devotee. Shatyavrata, Maharaj Shatyavrata is the devotee. And we learn something about him beginning in text number 10. Text number 10 says that he was a great king. But how is it that he was great? That's what we need to note here. How is it that he was great? Because there are many great kings described in the Vedic history, and some of them are great because they've conquered so many other kingdoms or done so many other extraordinary feats on the battlefield. But Shatyavrata Maharaj is described as great because he was Rajarshi. Rajarishi, as is described in the text number 10, Rajarishi. He was a great king because he was just like a saintly person. Although he was a king, his greatness was that he was like a saintly person. He was a rishi. And he was engaged in the performance of austerities and penances. This is the description we get of Maharaj Shatyavrata. We don't get the description that he had so many wives, he had so many palaces, he had so much wealth. We get the description that he's a Rajarshi and he likes to do penances and austerities. That's the picture we get of this great devotee. And so that's our introduction to the bhakta, Shatyavrata Maharaj. And in today's verse, we get an understanding about a clear picture of him, not only in this life as Maharaj Shatyavrata, but in his future lives as well. Sometimes we have a difficulty understanding, or we misunderstand, let's say, the demigods. And we see them with sort of a sakama devotees with material desires, and we don't get a true picture of them. But this canto in particular in Srimad Bhagavatam focuses on the manus and the systems of universal management. These are some of the themes also discussed a little earlier in this eighth canto. And so this verse, by describing Maharaj Shatyavrata, how in this millennium he later becomes the sun god, Vivaswan, gives us a broader understanding of not only of this individual devotee, but of the demigods in general, that they have their roots in being devotees of the Lord. Shraddhadeva, he later became Vivaswan. How? How did he get that post? What is his background? A lot of times we like to look at people that are prominent or famous in society today, and then, you know, what were they like before they were famous? What did they do? What was their qualification that got them to be famous? A few weeks ago, when that devotee from Hawaii was here, she was working at BTG for a while, training there. She's from Hawaii. What was her name? Krishna Lilian. She's from Australia, but she's from Hawaii. But she also had some connection with Obama. Both her and her brother had some connection with Obama when he was growing up in Hawaii. So they know, they can tell you, oh, this is his qualification. This is what he was like before he became famous. So what are the demigods like before they attain those positions? Well, this is explaining to us some of the background of the demigods, Maharshatravrata. He later became known as Vivasvan, the sun god, king of the sun planet. Well, he was a devotee. He was great because he was a Rajarshi. He liked to perform austerities and penances. And as we'll see as we go through these verses today, most of all, he was a bhakta. He was a devotee of the Lord. And that was his qualification for getting his position as a demigod. So when we think of the demigods, we should think of them as devotees of the Lord first, because that is their qualification, how they have attained their posts. And not only that, it explains to us that this universe, the ultimate principle behind the working of this universe, is devotion to the Supreme Lord, because that's how those who are managing things got their positions, through devotion to the Lord. So that bhakti, that relationship, that interaction between the Lord and his devotee, is actually the foundation of how all universal affairs take place. So that's what we get in text number 10 and 11. And then in text number 12, we find Maharshatravrata meeting the Supreme Lord. So text number 12, the translation: one day while King Shatravrata was performing austerities by offering water on the bank of the river Kritamala, a small fish appeared in the water in his palms. This verse is interesting because the bhakta Maharshatravrata is shown to be engaged in some devotional activity. The word, Sanskrit word used in this verse is anjali, palmful, anjali. One day while King Satyavrata was performing austerities by offering water on the bank of the river Kritamala, a small fish appeared in the water in his palms. And so he was engaged in a devotional activity there at the river. We know this word, pushpanjali, when we have appearance and disappearance of Srila Prabhupada. We have a pushpanjali celebration. So same kind of thing. Instead of pushpanjali, pushpa flowers, with a flower offering, he was offering water in the palms of his hands. And so he was in the act of devotion. It's interesting because it describes that he was offering water to the river. He wasn't drinking the water. Previously, the austerities described in text number 10 was that he subsisted only by drinking water. But here, in this text, it says that he wasn't drinking water at the river. He was actually performing worship by offering water with folded palms to the river Kritamala. And it's interesting that the Lord appeared in that situation. Another Sanskrit word in this verse is abhyapadyata. Adyapajata, was generated. Prabhupada translates it, appeared, a small fish appeared in the palms of his hands. So the Lord appears when there are acts of devotion. Bhagavan appears when the bhakta is engaged in bhakti or acts of devotion. That's when the Lord appeared in his hands. Not that he just happened to pick him up by accident, or the Lord was there in the river anyway. No, but by this act of devotion, this anjali, this offering with folded palms, in that situation, when there's bhakti, the Lord appears. The Lord did not appear when he was drinking water or performing austerities and penances. It's not that the Lord appears in those circumstances. The Lord appears when there is bhakti or devotion. Another three, we were talking about threes before. There's three things that don't cause the appearance of the Lord. even though they may be performed very expertly. Karma, jnana, and yoga, these three things. They may be performed very expertly, but because there's not bhakti there, the Lord doesn't appear. And so the Lord didn't appear to Maharishi Chaturvedi when he was performing austerities of drinking only water, but he appeared when he was engaged in acts of devotion with his anjali offerings that he was making to the river Kritamala. So Bhagavan appears to the devotee when there is bhakti, when there is devotion. Another interesting point to note about Maharishi Chaturvedi is that the Lord, the bhakta, he subsists on these devotional acts and not any other material thing. And that attracts the Lord to appear. He was not drinking the water, but he was worshiping. And so a devotee subsists mainly on the mercy of the Lord, not on any kind of material circumstance. And we see that in the lives of all the devotees, that they're not interested in any kind of material circumstance in life, but their real life, what really sustains their life and their existence, is their devotional practice. And by doing that, they're completely satisfied. So this is a little bit more, showing a little bit more about the character of the bhakta here, Maharishi Chaturvedi. And if we go to the next verse, so Maharishi Chaturvedi was performing austerities by offering water, anjali. And so then text number 13, Chaturvedi, the king of Dravida Desh, threw the fish into the water along with the water in his palm. O King Parikshit, descendant of Bharata. So here we're getting some introduction to Bhagavan, a little bit about the Matsya, the fish incarnation, is being described in text number 13 and particularly in the text number 14. But it's interesting to note here that Chaturvedi, when the Lord appeared in the palms of his hands, he put him back in the water. So he didn't recognize Bhagavan at first. He didn't recognize him. And this is sort of characteristic of the Lord, how he appears to his devotee. It's that quite often when the Lord appears, the devotees don't recognize him. Just like Jambavan. Jambavan, he is a great devotee of the Lord since the time of Lord Ramachandra. And during the pastimes of Lord Krishna, Krishna came to where he was living, and Jambavan thought him to be an intruder. And therefore, he engaged in fighting with him. I think they fought for 21 days, 28. Anyway, they fought for a long time, continuously. And throughout all that time, Jambavan didn't recognize who he was fighting with. Similarly, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, as a small boy, Nimai, stole the offering of the Brahmin who cooked three times, that Brahmin didn't recognize the Lord Chaitanya. He came, he was invited by Jagannath Mishra to his home, and he said, I have to cook for my deity. So Jagannath Mishra gave him everything to cook for his deity. He cooked once, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came and stole the offering. There was a big uproar, why he has come and done this. So Jagannath Mishra pacified the Brahmin, and he cooked a second time. Again, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came and stole the offering. And in the eyes and heart of the Brahmin, he had spoiled everything. Again, Jagannath Mishra convinced the Brahmin to cook. And again, even though he was locked up by his parents, little Nimai came and stole the offering one more time. And he explained to the Brahmin, when the Brahmin was complaining to him, why are you coming and spoiling my offering to the Lord? But can't you see I'm that same Lord that you're worshiping? Don't you understand? Can't you see? Can't you recognize me? And then by the mercy of the Lord, he revealed to the Brahmin who he was. And then the Bhakta could understand. So it's characteristic of the relationship between the Bhakta and Bhagavan that sometimes when they first meet, they don't recognize each other. But in this case of Marashatravata, he didn't recognize, but he continued his worshipful practice. He didn't just fling the fish away and carelessly, but again, this word is used, anjali. He offered the fish back to the river with the water in the palm of his hands. So this is characteristic of the Lord meeting with his devotees. So there's bhakta, there's Bhagavan, and then there's bhakti. And so in text number 14, we get a glimpse at what is this loving exchange between Satyavrata and Matsya. How is it executed? How is it felt between the two of them? So that's described here in text number 14. Translation is, with an appealing voice, the poor small fish said to King Satyavrata, who was very merciful, "My dear king, protector of the poor, why are you throwing me in the water of the river where there are other aquatics who can kill me? I am very much afraid of them." So, very interesting verse here. And in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says, in the Matsya Purana, it is said, Ananta Shaktir Bhagavan Matsya Rupi Janardana Kridartam Yachaya Yaasya Swayam Satyavratam Nirpa. The Supreme Personality of Godhead possesses unlimited potency. Nonetheless, in his pastime in the form of a fish, he begged protection from King Satyavrata. So, in his pastime, certainly the Supreme Lord possesses unlimited potency, and there's no reason for him to be afraid. Yet, he's presenting himself here before his devotee as if he was afraid of other aquatics killing him if he was put into the river. And it's interesting here, two words in the Sanskrit. One that describes the Matsya, Bhagavan, and the other that describes Satyavrata, the Bhakta. So, Bhagavan is described as Ati Karunam, extremely compassionate. And Satyavrata Maharaj is described as Maha Karunikam, extremely merciful. So the Lord is extremely compassionate. He has this ability, and as Prabhupada translates it here, with an appealing voice. His compassion, he understands compassion very deeply. And therefore, he knows how to evoke such compassion in the heart of his devotee. And so Srila Prabhupada says here, with an appealing voice. So this appealing voice, this feeling of compassion or an expression for evoking the compassion of others is how the Lord begins his relationship with his bhakta, with this kind of a loving feeling. He makes an appealing voice to him that certainly cannot be denied. I mean, we have experience, all of us, of people coming to us and asking us something, asking us for help or advice or whatever in a very appealing way. My daughter was at her work the other day at CVS, and she went to Walmart, one of these stores. She was at Walmart, and so someone came up to her in the aisle, you know, and asked, "Do you have some money for gas?" You know, so I'm sure their appeal was like to evoke the sympathy, so they could, you know, she would give them some money for gas. So we all have this experience of people making some appeal to us, appealing to our compassion. What to speak of the Supreme Lord Himself, who is described as Ati Karunam, extremely compassionate, if He makes this request of us. And this is what He did with His appealing voice to Maharashtravata. He asked for help and protection in a very, very appealing way. And in response to that, the Bhakta Maharashtravata, he is described as Mahakruni Karunikam, extremely merciful. And so the Lord, He reciprocates with His devotees and brings out the devotional qualities of the devotee. Maharashtravata, by the performance of his austerities, by being a Rajarshi, was a very developed these sentiments and was very compassionate by nature. And so the Lord's interaction with him was done just right, just in just a way to evoke that most extremely merciful nature so that he would reciprocate with him. And so with an appealing voice, the Lord placed himself under the protection of his devotee. This is also characteristic of the loving relationship or bhakti between the Lord and his devotees, that even though the Lord is the supreme controller, possesses unlimited potency, he likes to be put under the care or the protection of his devotees. We know that Mother Yasoda, for instance, Krishna reciprocates in love with Mother Yasoda and puts himself as the son under her care and under her protection. He relishes that position, and the devotee relishes giving such protection. This is a bhakti, the loving exchange between the Lord and his devotees. Similarly, the Lord is, even though the Lord is puts himself in this position of being dependent on his devotees, the devotee understands by this exchange of bhakti who the Lord is. And that we find in the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, where Rupa Goswami, he recognized Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as the Supreme Lord based on an understanding of his extremely compassionate nature. We know this verse, Namo Mahala Nadaya Krishna Prema Padayate Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namne Gaur Tivase Namaha. Is that the verse, or is that Sarvam Bhattacharya's verse? That's the verse. Okay. So he recognized the Lord. He recognized the Lord because he was extremely compassionate. He can understand, oh, here's my Lord, by the exhibition of this compassionate nature, even though he appeared in a covered way. He appeared as a devotee of the Lord, but the real bhakta could understand the nature of the Lord by his extremely compassionate nature. And so even though the Lord puts himself under the control of his devotee by the interaction of love between them, the Lord, the devotee can understand, oh, here is my Lord. And so this is the exchange, this appealing voice of the Lord and Maharashtravata, as described in text number 15, how he responded. It's described here that to please himself, King Kshatriyavraja, not knowing that the fish was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, decided with great pleasure to give the fish protection. Srila Prabhupada's purport, here is an example of giving service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even without knowledge. Such service is called Agyata Sukriti. King Satyavrata wanted to show his own mercy, not knowing that the fish was Lord Vishnu. But such unknowing devotional service, by such unknowing devotional service, one is favored by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Service rendered to the Supreme Lord, knowingly or unknowingly, never goes in vain. And so the significant point here is that to please himself. But what is that pleasing himself that Maharaj Satyavrata is engaged in? It's not just in disregard for others or in disregard for religious principles. That in pleasing himself is meant to be to show his sacrificing for others, to being merciful, and doing it with a feeling of pleasure. These are characteristics of this idea of doing it for himself, to please himself. But because he was interacting with the Supreme Lord, and because the Supreme Lord is always Bhagavan, not that he's not Bhagavan, even though he may disguise himself or hide in various ways, he remains Bhagavan. So, knowingly or unknowingly, if with this kind of attitude of sacrifice for others, and in a pleasing way trying to serve the Lord, serve the fish incarnation here, or even us in any circumstance we may be in, trying to benefit the devotees of the Lord, that attitude is a gata sukriti, and it enables the Lord to reciprocate with the devotee, even if the devotee doesn't know he's reciprocating with the Supreme Lord. And so, by this type of interaction, the Lord satisfies the devotee, and the Lord is satisfied by the devotee's reciprocation. That is agyata sukriti. So, bhakta, Bhagavan, and bhakti, these things are always there and can be analyzed in this way when we're studying the Lord's incarnations and his interactions with the devotees. So are there any comments or questions about these subject matters? Yes.
King Satyavrata doing this compassionate act to please himself. There's a lot of times people talk like that, you know, that where they equate being nice with being compassionate. And Prabhupada talks about the idea that you have to understand what compassion is, such as you don't save the shirt of a drowning man, you have to save the man himself. But what I was getting, and I think you were touching on it, but I wanted to make sure I understood, is that King Satyavrata got a nice warm feeling from helping the fish. And the fish was saying, no, you're not helping me. You know, the aquatics are going to eat me, so can you do something useful for me? And so I was just wondering, you know, like, and in Kali Yuga, like you mentioned, your daughter, you know, being accosted by somebody who wanted money for gas, without fail, that's always a scam. And so, you know, I would imagine if that fish had appeared in Kali Yuga, you know, at some point after he got bigger, he would have turned around and eaten the king. Because that seems to be the way. No good deed goes unpunished. So I'm trying to, like, circle around an idea here that, you know, how do we understand when we're actually being compassionate and doing actual good for someone else? Not just for our own pleasure so that we get that nice warm feeling, but maybe it requires some sacrifice, and maybe we don't really even know what it is that we're doing, you know, that will help somebody.
Well, if you engage in, or if anybody, let's say anybody, engages in activities, even just to please themselves, and the person they're interacting with is a devotee of the Lord, or is, if we're fortunate enough, as Maharaj Satyavrata was, to be interacting with the Supreme Lord himself, that in activity, even though it may give us a warm, fuzzy feeling inside that would ordinarily be material, because it's in relation to the Lord or his devotees, then it's actually a jhata sukriti. Actually, there's some benefit there, because the Lord or his devotees don't stop being the Lord or his devotees just because they're the objects of someone's mundane views.
Yes, but at the same time, there's also the idea, because there used to be, like, you know, the attitude, oh, don't give money for, you know, don't give money to beggars because they're just going to use it in sense gratification. And it seems the pendulum has swung in the other direction. We must be nice to everyone in all circumstances, even if it's not actually helpful, because that's what a devotee is soft-hearted. I'm not talking about necessarily the Lord all the time, but just the idea that a devotee is compassionate in general, and so, you know, we'll give to this charity, save the whales, do this, do that. And you know, how do we understand, as we're getting that good feeling, I don't have anything against good feeling, I'm just trying to understand, what do we do that is actually compassionate towards others, not particularly the Lord, because we have so many opportunities and we know what those are, but towards other living entities, because the king didn't know the fish was the Lord.
Well, whatever a devotee does should ultimately, our interaction with all living entities and everything we do in life is ultimately to try to give Krishna consciousness to others. And so people may be able to take that to one degree or another. Like Prabhupada said, even, you know, when distributing books and things like that, if they go away angry, that's your nonsense, he said, you know, about it. So it's not that we should have them go away angry. He would do things like greet people good morning rather than Hare Krishna, all in an attempt to create a favorable impression in their mind about the devotees of the Lord, about the Lord himself. And so that should be the guiding thing that devotee acts, that guides his behavior. But that may be manifest in a number of different ways. As you said, it may be even sort of a forceful situation where sometimes you try to give someone Krishna so that they understand, and it might not be according to, say, moral kind of situation or something like that. But if our desire is situated right to give Krishna consciousness and not to exploit, or not driven by our own conditioning of the material nature, then we can feel comfortable in any circumstance we're in, either being however we interact with somebody, as long as we're trying to give them Krishna consciousness. But we know that most interaction with people, if they get some kind of reaction or interaction with us that leaves them dissatisfied, angry, frustrated, or something like that, that's not going to help them become Krishna conscious. And so we need to try to do things in such a way that people do have the most opportunity to become Krishna conscious. Not everyone will, but our endeavor should be to give them the most opportunity to do that. I don't know if that responds to your...
It feels very complex to me, because even sometimes people say, well, people don't like us going out on Harinam. You know, they're annoyed by our Harinam, so maybe we should stop doing them, you know?
Well, I don't think that's what we should do, no. But there's a difference between being annoyed by the Harinam and doing it in such a way that doesn't engender a bad reaction to it or something. I remember one time I was in Helsinki, and we went on Harinam in a department store there, and I don't know how the managers of the department store felt about it, but, you know, they had the police chasing us through the store. And I don't know that was like the best thing to do in terms of a Harinam, if there is an alternative someplace else, because it may not be able to last too long. It depends how quickly you get caught, you know. So it is complex, and the devotee obviously depends upon Krishna in every circumstance to guide him in doing that. When we first went into that store, I thought it was quite bold of the older devotees to do that. And so maybe it wasn't a mistake, you know, maybe it was just, you know, my own hesitancy to give Krishna consciousness. But we have to try. We try and endeavor to serve in different ways, and we see what the results are, and we learn from the results. We do have to learn from the results. Any other
ones? You know the story of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta was on Parikrama, and he told his householders to give money to the beggars because money, I hold money, so it's for me, so he wanted them to give up. So we could say, your daughter could be thinking, well, I have $10 in my pocket and I want to buy a shirt, and this person's asking for money. If I give this person money, I won't be able to buy the shirt, but that'll be good for me because I'll transcend my desire, and I have enough shirts anyway. So what about situations like that where it's not, this is a total gray area, it's not black and white boxes, it's just I have something by God's grace and someone else doesn't have it, and it's not even going to necessarily, they're not even going to know I'm a devotee, it's all about me holding on to something. Does that play into this?
Yeah, of course it does.
And how could we or should or shouldn't we manifest that?
Well, we also have our own purification to go through in terms of these kind of situations. We have trying to give the other person Krishna consciousness to our best of our ability so that they can benefit most, but we also have the obligation to purify ourselves, and that's why Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur told him to give. Otherwise, he said, your heart will become hard. You'll be thinking, as you said, I have this and it's for me and I'm going to keep it for me. It doesn't matter what other people may need. And so he had them give, especially the householders. There was their duty to give that charity so that their own hearts become purified. So in our interactions with the public or anybody else, devotees' interactions with the public or anybody else, including Bhagavan, the Supreme Lord, there are two objectives: to please the other person, to give them the most opportunity to benefit in Krishna consciousness, and also to purify our hearts. And so there may be a circumstance where a person doesn't have an opportunity to be given directly Krishna consciousness, but if I have an opportunity to purify my own heart, then I should do that. I should do, because that'll make me more able and give me a better vision of how to interact with people so they can be Krishna conscious. They can get at Krishna consciousness. How would you answer your own question?
This guy I met in New York, I was in New York, I was walking down the street, and this guy comes up to me. He saw I was a devotee. He was like, he didn't really know devotees, but I guess he thought devotees had money. So I said, you know, I'm hungry, can you give me $5? And I'm like, oh, you're just going to eat meat and you're going to drink and you're going to smoke. I was just joking with him. And he goes, no, I won't. I go, I don't believe you. So we're going back and forth, you know. And I was thinking, you know, I have a business with $5. It's like, you know, it's not really significant. And so I made him promise. He wouldn't smoke. He wouldn't buy any liquor. I said, you better promise you're not going to buy any liquor. You're not going to buy any meat because I'm going to get your karma at you. So I don't know what he did, but that was about as far as I've gone with.
Well, that's good. You interacted with him. You know, you just didn't know, forget it, get away from me, you bum. You know, you said, okay, look, are you going to benefit yourself? Or I'm willing to sacrifice, but are you going to benefit yourself by this? Or are you going to degrade yourself by this? And so that's a good interaction to have.
But he was saying Hare Krishna the whole time. But I should have, yeah. I was more concerned about my karma. So I don't know. I lost sight of the... Anyway.
She was wearing... You could tell she was drugged out, you know, big time. She was... You know, she was probably like 40 years old and looked like 65. She was wearing a Radha Krishna t-shirt, and I called her over. I never give money to bums on the street, and I called her over. I said, I'm giving you this dollar just because you're wearing that t-shirt. And she said, oh, thank you. She didn't even know what she was wearing. It was so funny.
Okay. Anything else? Anyone else? Yes, on the mind.
Along the same line, sometimes we go out on Harinam, like especially the football games, and we're distributing Krishna the Reservoir of Pleasure. We have a box that's been donated, and we're handing them out. These people are, you know, fairly intoxicated, and often we find them on the ground. So I just want to know your view on this, because it's a controversial thing. Like, should we hand them out, and then they disrespect the, you know, pictures of, you know, the whole book being walked on? Or should we, you know, should we be giving them out freely? So that,
well, I mean, one thing is that a lot of times our literature distribution or our missionary activities, our preaching activities, are characterized in terms of war analogies. And so I think a war analogy is appropriate in response to your question. In war, sometimes what they do is they leaflet the enemy. They'll fly over enemy territory and they'll just throw out leaflets, like thousands and millions of them, you know, knowing that, you know, not everyone's going to get read or not everyone's going to be effective, but the whole attempt is to, like, saturate them with ideas that will make them either weaker or surrender or whatever. And so, in a sense, our missionary activities are like that, especially with literatures, inexpensive literatures like that. We're leafleting. We know that everyone is not going to be respected. We know everyone's not going to be read. But the point is to cover the entire field with them, with the hope of getting a few sincere souls to see. So it can be seen in that way as well, and not either as wasteful or disrespectful, but as liquid. So I think we should end at that point. Antaraj Srimad Bhagavatam.